Prescription medications can cure you of serious infections and can also help you live a much happier and healthier life despite chronic conditions. But not surprisingly, it's important to know how you should be taking care of these powerful drugs and how to take these powerful drugs safely. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Really pleased to have a couple of expert pharmacists with us today. Casey Gallimore is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Madison School of Pharmacy. She currently practices pharmacy at the William T. Evu Access Community Healthcare Center, where she works with a behavioral health team, and they together provide coordinated psychiatric and medical care to patients in a primary care setting. And Dr. Gallimore, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
John Dopp is also an associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. He practices at the Wisconsin Sleep Center, again, a multidisciplinary team focusing on therapy of sleep disorders, hypertension, and other conditions for patients with sleep problems. And Dr. Dopp, thank you for spending time with us today as well. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry. Thank you for having us.
Really appreciate it. And I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. I hope you will. Do you need to know about the medications that you're on? How do you find out about them? If you've been on a particular medication for a while, might there be options that are at least things to think about? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Well, you both teach at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. What kind of training does a pharmacist really get? I have a good friend who's a pharmacist, and I know she went through a lot of training, for sure, Casey.
Sure. So most of our students have at least 2 years of undergrad work. Yep. Some of our students have a full four-year degree in various programs. Yep. Once they're in the pharmacy school, they do 3 years of didactic coursework. And throughout that time, they also do rotations at various pharmacy settings, both inpatient, outpatient, retail pharmacy settings. And then their fourth year is all about rotation, so they're actually working as practicing pharmacists under the supervision of a licensed pharmacist, and they're performing all of the activities that they would when they graduate and become a licensed pharmacist, so they get some real practical experience.
And there is a pretty extensive exam. At least if I'm not mistaken, as I'm remembering from my talking to my friend, a very extensive exam that people have to take in order to finally qualify as a pharmacist here, if I'm not mistaken, John.
Yeah, that's true. In the state of Wisconsin, in order to become a licensed pharmacist, one is required to pass a national licensing exam. We call it the NAPLEX exam. Mm-hmm. They're also required, in order to become a Wisconsin pharmacist, to pass the Wisconsin state law exam. So there's two big exams. Previously, you used to have to pass a compounding exam, mm-hmm. but sort of as a result of the transition of more and more products being prefabricated and coming from manufacturers and less of a focus on compounding, they decided not to have that be part of the exam anymore. There also used to be a counseling portion of the exam, and it was a very difficult exam to administer in an objective fashion.
Sure.
And so that the board had sort of agreed to do away with that one for practical reasons as well. But it's a difficult course.
What a pharmacist, what are they able to do and maybe not do as it relates to prescribing and providing medications? Casey, we'll start with you.
Sure. Pharmacists are great at performing med reviews, advising in terms of prescribing. Most pharmacists, we don't have an extensive training in diagnosis, mm-hmm. But pharmacists are really qualified once we have a diagnosis, know what we're treating, to make the most appropriate recommendations. I would say, depending on the setting they're in, there are some exceptions. Most pharmacists aren't the ones doing the actual prescribing, but at the clinic that I'm at, I provide a lot of recommendations to the prescribers that take on the prescribing. There are settings in the VA and some other settings where pharmacists do assume that responsibility of the prescribing.
One of the common questions about drugs, actually, I think Rosie in Eagle River has a question that's pretty common, so let's go there. Rosie, hi, thank you so much for calling.
Hi, Larry, thanks for taking my call. In I was just looking for some sort of an objective opinion. I wondered if your guests could speak a little bit about generics versus brand name statins. I personally had a intolerance to Lipitor, which was giving me muscle pain and elevated liver enzymes, and my GP just changed me over to a generic simvastatin, and I sort of think statin, they're all the same. And I had just seen a cardiologist recently. I've been on simvastatin for 5 years, and he wants me to switch to Crestor, and I asked what would be the reason for that. The simvastatin's working just fine, and basically all I got from him was, well, I really like that drug, and that's the drug I take, and I wouldn't give it to you if I didn't take it, and that's fine, but I was looking for a little something more science-based about why is the, I mean, obviously,
sure. Makes
companies,
sense.
It's a benefit to them, and it's a detriment to our pocketbook, so.
Yep, understood. So, John, start with you.
Rosie, that's a great question. Thank you for calling in and asking it, because it is something that many patients are faced with on a pretty frequent basis, particularly when they're switching. And obviously, I don't know exactly the perspective that your general practitioner was taking when he made that switch or recommendation. Statins are very similar from one agent to the other. However, there are some key differences between them, and I think what your prescriber may have been getting at is that Crestor is a little more potent at lowering the cholesterol levels compared to simvastatin. Simvastatin is very effective at lowering your cholesterol levels, and there's all kinds of other benefits in such that they lower your cardiac risk for things like heart attack and stroke and things like that. But Crestor does that as well. Simvastatin does it. They've all been studied somewhat differently, and Crestor is very potent at producing, I would say, at the doses used clinically, somewhat slightly larger reductions in your cholesterol level. So it may be that your physician has just had good luck with his patients in terms of reducing the cholesterol levels with Crestor. Admittedly, it probably is more expensive than simvastatin, which has gone generic. But even to everyone's disappointment, generic simvastatin is still a little pricier than we would all like it to be, given that it's a generic. So I don't think there's really a difference between, say, a brand name Crestor and the fact that the simvastatin is a generic product. The generic statins I've never heard of any problems with them not working well. There's sometimes patients will complain about something that when I went from the brand simvastatin to the generic simvastatin, I didn't tolerate it, or it gave me a side effect, or it worked differently. And in rare cases, that can happen, but I think it's generally related to the inert ingredients that are in the drug. There's binders and resins and fillers in the tablets.
Sure.
Sometimes there's dyes in the tablets as well, if they're not just white.
Sure.
And sometimes people have a different reaction to those ingredients, and it's not very common, but it certainly can happen.
Well, Rosie, thank you so much for calling. And I mean, she asked a good question there, and as you approach a pharmacist or you're being prescribed a medication, what are the kinds of questions? That was a good question to ask a pharmacist. What else would you ask a pharmacist that would be a reasonable question? I'm thinking here, just off the top of my head, one might be, should I take this with food, or what else might there be?
Yeah, I think administration issues are a good thing to ask about. If you are experiencing any sort of side effects, I think that's a great thing to ask about, because pharmacists can let you know whether this is a serious side effect that might involve you needing to switch the medication, or whether this is something that they can recommend something that might minimize it to make it more tolerable. Drug interactions, I notice there's some people that look like they're putting in questions related to drug interactions. Pharmacists, because they have your whole profile there, are really good at being able to identify and proactively make recommendations to avoid or minimize drug interactions. I have a lot of patients ask about adherence aids. So if you're one of those patients that has a really complex regimen, you're on a lot of medications, dosed a lot of times a day, pharmacists are really good at helping with adherence aids, whether it's pill boxes, whether it's reminders. Adherence aids are an important part too.
And I assume, if you're going to the same pharmacist all the time, that pharmacist, he or she's has your whole list. I know some people with elderly, parents, for example, where, gee whiz, there's so many different medications that they're taking. And I know in cases where the pharmacist has said to at least one couple, I think that we need to have a review this. These are just not, I think we need to make some changes, because there's just too many and there's whatever the person said was
definitely
useful.
Yeah, and sometimes the pharmacist, if you fill at one single pharmacy, even if you're going to multiple prescribers, sometimes it's the pharmacist is the one that can really truly see all of the medications that a patient's taking. Because if you're getting drugs from a lot of different prescribers, you know, specialists, your primary care doctor, sometimes they might not even be aware of other things that you're on.
So, again, thanks very much for that question, Rosie. I appreciate it very much. What about if you're on, now she was on five years, I think she was on Simvastatin, which seems to be that's kind of long. I don't, or is that long? Or seems like a long time to me.
Usually statins are a long-term sort of indefinite therapy, yes.
Okay, so when you're on one of those, I guess, as, you know, let's say I'm on one of those Simvastatins, for example, what should I be asking? How, you know, do you check, do you need to check on the dosage and that sort of thing often, or?
Yeah, generally the prescriber will get you kind of stabilized on the dose that works best for you. But we want, those medications are not unlike other medications in that they do require some follow-up monitoring for safety. Physicians should be monitoring laboratory values that like functions of your liver tests, liver function tests, measuring things like your muscle. There's markers in your blood for muscle breakdown. One of the things that Rosie described was having muscle pains and muscle aches from her Lipitor.
Yeah.
And so that's, unfortunately, a fairly common side effect that patients will get, and it causes breakdown of muscle, and so they monitor for that pretty regularly. So that's one of the most important things, is making sure you're seeing your doctor on a regular basis to be evaluated if the drug is working, checking your cholesterol levels, and to be monitoring for toxicity to make sure that there's no side effects or bigger problems going on. But it's also good, you know, statins are maybe not the best example of that, but checking in with your physician and your pharmacist every once in a while, making sure that medications are working well together, that there's no interactions, and that if you're taking something for a relatively short period of time, is there a medication that we could, in theory, get rid of and try to taper off?
Yeah. It's kind of interesting to me to see the television ads for the various pharmaceutical companies, and they're saying, ask your doctor or ask your pharmacist for this specific drug, and you know, and maybe it is a good thing to ask in some cases, maybe it's not in others. How do you find out about new drugs, or if some are better than others, you know, than the ones you're taking now?
I think that would be another great question to ask the pharmacist. So if you see those ads on TV and you're wondering about whether that might be an appropriate drug for you, a pharmacist is a great person to ask. Pharmacists are really good at keeping up on the studies on that come out. So not just what are the new approvals, but even with the older drugs, what are the new studies that are coming out that might have new indications or studied in new areas.
Taking a look at prescriptions with a couple of pharmacists today, and professors as well. Casey Gilmore is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Pharmacy. John Dopp, associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy as well. Casey practices, works with in the behavior area, and John works with, focuses on therapy of sleep disorders, hypertension, and other kinds of conditions in those areas. So great to have them with us, and we'll take some more calls here. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're learning how to use pharmacists as a resource in order to take our medications safely and effectively. I would certainly love to have you join in with your questions as we visit with Casey Gallimore and John Dopp, who are pharmacists at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, and professors there as well. Donna in Hartford has a question for you, so let's go to her. Donna, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you, Larry and guests, for showcasing this very important topic. I wanted to really wave a big thank you flag to pharmacists in my area in particular, and I want to let the general public know how very, very helpful they are, and you really need to make use of them as an excellent resource when you are taking medications, either long-term or just having to take something for a short time, especially when it comes to possible interactions with natural supplements that you may also be on. My family is a big proponent for taking many different kinds of natural supplements, which include herbs. And oftentimes, herbs do throw strong bad reactions or interactions. They don't mix well with prescription drugs. And your pharmacists have wonderful resource books that they can look these things up in, and help you to steer clear of that sort of thing. And a big thing too that has come up is oftentimes prescription meds, you don't want it to be taking a lot of magnesium with them. The pharmacist can explain why, because of the binding agents and things interacts that way. And so many supplements have magnesium in them, a magnesium stearate or some form of magnesium. And so I just wanted to thank pharmacists for their help and to really encourage people to use them. Doctors can prescribe, but pharmacists are the ones who have really, really studied about these medications, and they can really help you. Also, two other things I want to throw out. The big deal about, and I know for some pharmacists will say, make sure you drink plenty of water. I think too many people just kind of go, I'll just take a couple sips. It's how important it is, and your guests can speak to that, how important it is to get enough water in when you're taking your medication so that they work well in the body. And then also I wanted to ask the pharmacists how they feel, or are they able to promote or at least suggest when people come to the counter taking antibiotics to promote the use of probiotics, the 2 to 3 hour rule, to help our folks taking antibiotics to help them have the best colon health, and especially in older folks or whatever, or people that are on a lot of antibiotics to prevent C. diff, which is a very severe infection.
So lots of good things there, Donna. Thank you so much for calling. And she makes some good points, Casey.
Yeah, in terms of the probiotics with antibiotics, I think what she's getting at is, antibiotics are great at killing bacteria in the body, but they also sometimes kill the normal flora that's in the GI tract, which protects us from some infections. And so by taking probiotics along with antibiotics, especially if you're a patient, not even if you've had a C. diff infection, which is a pretty serious infection, but if you have difficulty with diarrhea as a side effect with antibiotics, in the past, probiotics is something that you can do proactively to help you tolerate the antibiotic a little bit better.
She talked about water and taking water sort of with your tablets, and a lot of people, well, frankly, myself included, I don't take enough of it probably at night. Just before bedtime, I'm, reluctant with the one little thing that I have to take a whole bunch of water. But what about water?
Well, you want to obviously make sure you're drinking enough water with your medications to not have difficulty swallowing them, to provide enough liquid in the stomach where the tablets are dissolving and disintegrating to be able to get into your system quickly. And hydration overall, as she mentioned, is a great, great principle to be following. One of the key things with regards to hydration is certain medications could be more problematic to certain individuals when they become dehydrated. Simple over-the-counter medications like ibuprofen, if you're dehydrated all the time, can cause some problems with your kidneys. And so making sure that you're always hydrated because of various individual medications that could just either not work as well or cause some toxicity is a good idea.
And, she makes another good point. I was thinking about how things are handled with my own medical care. I have a listing, or they have in the computer, a list of the various, one-a-day type vitamin and this or that thing that I have, vitamin D that I might take and some other things. And I think those aren't prescription, but as she points out, there could be some interaction depending on what you've got and what you're taking.
Yeah, definitely. I think people, a lot of times, because you can buy herbals and OTCs over the counter, people assume that they're safe, and especially herbals, they think that, natural products. The fact is they still produce an effect in the body, and sometimes very similar to some of the medications that we take. And they can interact negatively, and I think a pharmacist is a great person to check before you start anything over the counter, whether you've gotten a recommendation from a friend or a family member, or just something you've read about that you want to try. They can do a quick check to let you know not only will it interact with your medications, but whether it would be something worth buying, whether it's a chance that it might be effective for whatever you're looking to treat.
Nancy in Milwaukee has a question for us, so let's go there. Nancy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning to you. I'm calling because I have three seemingly unrelated symptoms, and these symptoms consist of a tremendous amount of hair loss, a lot of tinnitus, and hoarseness. And the drug that I'm taking is actually an over-the-counter drug, which people mostly buy for allergy relief, but I happen to take this to put myself to sleep at night. And the name of the drug is diphenhydramine hydrochloride, 25 milligrams. And I'm wondering if taking this drug is what is causing the drying of my follicles, which produces the hair loss, the drying of cilia in my inner ear, which produces the tinnitus, and the drying of throat membranes, which produces my hoarseness. And if you think that this is true, I would be happy not to take this drug, but then I would like you to perhaps be able to suggest another one that I could use to go to sleep at night.
Well, John, this is kind of right up your alley. Pretty much, I think, because that's, you know, kind of one of the things you deal with is sleep and sleep disorders.
Exactly. Thanks, Nancy, for the question. I'm sorry you're experiencing those adverse effects from the medicine. And you seem to have some insight into that in saying that is it drying out my throat, drying out my follicles, and drying out my ear to cause these issues. The hoarseness and the you know, there's no secret that antihistamines like diphenhydramine by how they work will cause a drying of certain tissues of your body, right? That's why we take them for allergies, is they mm-hmm. stop the mucus production and the runny nose and the symptoms that go along with that. But when you take them for other purposes, they can cause drying out of tissues that can be problematic. And in your case, you seem to be experiencing some of those. The hoarseness, I could certainly consider could be related to the diphenhydramine. It dries your throat out. It can dry your upper airway out. And so it could be a culprit there. It's difficult to say with the hair fall, with the hair loss and with the tinnitus. Those are not two of the most commonly reported side effects with the antihistamine. But one of the things that I know Casey and I always say is, It's not one of the most commonly reported side effects. It's not something we think about right away, but in any given patient, I guess it could be related. And you mentioned recommending something. How often, Nancy, if I can ask you back, how many nights a week are you using the antihistamine for sleep?
Almost every single night. Now, these pills are 25 milligram, and although the dose to put yourself to sleep is two of them, I usually only take a half of one or one. Mm-hmm. And what I would like recommended for me is not a prescription drug, but simply something else that I could buy over the counter.
Sure. One thing I do want to make sure I mention, and this is something whether you're seeing your primary physician or you're seeing a sleep specialist will tell you, is if you're needing a medicine for your sleep every night to help you, it's probably a really good idea to mention that to your primary physician so that they're aware of it and they can evaluate you. A lot of times when someone has a hard time sleeping, there's other medical things that could be going on, and they want to make sure, we want to make sure that we're not missing something that could be a cause of you having a hard time sleeping or a contributing factor to difficulty sleeping. So I would make sure that your physician knows and they can sort of monitor this if you're needing a sleeping medicine all the time. Over-the-counter diphenhydramine is probably the most effective, but interestingly enough, when you use it every night, it does lose its effectiveness. You get tolerance to the sedating effects pretty quickly, sometimes as rapidly as 4 to 7 nights if you're using it every night. The other options over the counter, there are not very many. There would be things like the herbal products, valerian root, and things like that, but there's very questionable efficacy that we don't have a lot of studies to show that they're to prove that they're effective in a lot of people. The other option would be something like melatonin, which is a hormone our body naturally produces. And melatonin is fairly safe, but it can still have some drug interactions with medications like warfarin. which is a big problem if we produce drug interactions with that. So it's difficult to say. Those are some of the options. I'd hesitate to make a firm recommendation without having access to all of your other medicines and things like that. But you know, as I think one of the themes we've been discussing today is Nancy, this would be a great question to take to your pharmacist and say, would these medications be for me, given everything else that I'm taking? And then certainly, like we discussed, keeping your physician in the loop.
Yeah, that's very good points. Thanks, Nancy, for calling. How do these drugs work exactly, or generally, maybe medications for sleep disorders. Typically, what do they do? They relax you, or do they?
There's a couple of different kinds of medications for sleep disorders. So Nancy mentioned antihistamines, which have some effect. The antihistaminic effect also produces some sedation. But most of the prescription sleep medications work by mimicking a brain chemical that makes us drowsy. And it stimulates receptors that this brain chemical has affinity for. And by doing that, the body thinks that we have a larger amount of this sleep-promoting brain chemical in our central nervous system, thereby making us sleepy and helping us sleep. Unfortunately, by mimicking that chemical, it can also produce some side effects that patients, you know, should be on the lookout for and that we need to be careful about, hence the reason those medications are prescription only.
Could they be dependency-related or issues?
Yes, almost all of the sleep medications for quote-unquote treating insomnia are what we call controlled substances. It means they have the possibility of producing physical dependency and a possibility of abuse. In practice, we see, at least in the sleep clinic, very few people who develop an addiction or abuse problem with them, but physical dependency is real. So what that means is if you stop taking it cold turkey, your body will go through some sort of a withdrawal. And so we need to, if we're stopping taking it and you've been on it for some time, slowly taper the dose down to avoid problems. So that's something to talk about. Before you stop or start any medication, that's something that we always teach our students to tell their patients is always talk to your doctor or your pharmacist before you start or stop any medication, because we may need to reduce them gradually because of things like dependency.
Yeah, so we should, Casey, get you a chance to talk a little bit about depression and anxiety treatments that you're involved in. What are some of the common types of medications that you use to treat depression and anxiety?
Sure. Depression and anxiety, the most common medications you'd see for both conditions actually are antidepressants. Normally we think of antidepressant medication for only treating depression, but it's really a mainstay of treating anxiety long-term as well. So medications like the SSRIs, so like Prozac, fluoxetine, sertraline, Zoloft, we have SNRIs as well, which are similar to SSRIs, except for they affect not only serotonin, but also norepinephrine in the body. So venlafaxine or Effexor would be a common medication there. The downside with the antidepressants is that they do take a while to start to work, and so that's one of the major counseling points with those is usually it takes at least a couple of weeks before patients will see any sort of improvement in depression or anxiety symptoms, and it can take up to 4 to 6 weeks or longer to see max effect with those medications.
And I talked to somebody who whose brother was on one of those medications for depression, and then he had feeling so good that then he immediately took himself off, and so he went right back into the sort of cyclical thing. Do you see that in your practice?
You do, yeah. I think a lot of people don't realize that depression is, like you said, cyclic. And so usually once you're on an antidepressant and it's starting to work, we like that person to be on it for up to a year, or we say 4 to 9 months after they get real good benefit from that medication. At that point, then, it becomes a discussion with the prescriber of whether it's worth tapering off or not. You know, if this is a person, it's a first episode of depression, it probably is worth a trial off, just because a lot of people, we don't want them to be on medications long-term if they don't have to.
Sure.
However, you will see people on them long-term if this is someone that has had multiple episodes of depression or very severe depression, maybe with suicidal ideation, where it might be dangerous for them to go off of treatment. But just like John mentioned with the sleep aids, antidepressants, you do want to taper off of those. And if patients stop them abruptly, they can get what is called a discontinuation syndrome, which isn't dangerous, but it's pretty uncomfortable for the patient. And within a couple of days after stopping the antidepressant, you can get almost flu-like symptoms, chills, body aches, and they do go away with time, a week or two, but we can prevent them altogether by tapering them off the medication.
Ann in Madison has a question for you, so let's turn to her. Ann, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I've recently been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and my doctor wants to start me on methotrexate, and I just have some questions about this drug, sort of the drug, the class of drugs itself, and how effective it really is at maybe altering the course of the disease, and any side effects that I should be looking for. And then I've been reading about it, and it says that you shouldn't drink alcohol with it, and I've heard differing reports on that, so I guess I would like your opinion on alcohol consumption with this drug.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who wants to take a crack at that? John, do you feel like you...
And I can provide you with a little bit of evidence, but it's been a while since I've practiced in a rheumatology clinic, so I'll do my best. I'm first of all, sorry to hear about that. Hopefully the medication is helpful for you, and that if you do take it, that it works well and it doesn't cause too many problems. Methotrexate is one of those medications, I think, that they classify as being a disease-modifying agent. And when you treat rheumatoid arthritis, there's two approaches, and one is just to sort of treat the symptoms, the inflammation, the pain, and traditionally they can do that with medications like ibuprofen or naproxen or medications like that. But the in terms of altering the course of the disease and slowing the progression of it, methotrexate is definitely a drug that can do that, and I think that's probably why your rheumatologist or your physician decided to put you on it, is that, hey, we can slow down the progression of this, the deterioration of the joints, the changing of the joint tissue, and then, you know, hopefully keeping you able to have some good function. Rheumatoid arthritis can be, over the long term, somewhat disabling. And so slowing down the progression is indeed the goal in terms of not just treating the symptoms of the pain and the stiffness, but also in terms of modifying the disease itself.
What about a glass of wine or alcohol of any amounts with this medication? Do you like to, Casey, what do you think?
I'm with John and the fact that it's been a long time since I've looked a lot at the rheumatoid arthritis medications. My recollection of it is that alcohol should be avoided. Now, I know some patients with methotrexate, I'm not sure what Ann's regimen is, don't necessarily take it on a daily basis. There are regimens where they take it a day or 2 days out of the week. And I have had patients that have separated the alcohol on the days that they don't take the methotrexate, but I wouldn't say that's a solid recommendation.
One way or the other. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Something you probably want to take back up again with your doctor, your own physician. But thanks, Ann, for calling. I'm glad you called. Robert emailed us and wondered how a patient finds out the manufacturing origins of medications. He's concerned that I'm getting a medication made in India, but of course with Chinese-based compounds, for example.
Good question, Robert. There's a lot of people who are concerned about where their medications are coming from and where they're manufactured. I think the place to start would be to ask your pharmacist who the generic manufacturer is of your product. If it's a generic product, if it's a branded product, find out who the manufacturer is. Many times it'll say it on your prescription vial, depending on which pharmacy you use. It'll say either Teva Pharmaceuticals or Mylan Pharmaceuticals. You can find that out. And then to communicate with your pharmacist about contact information for the company in terms of finding out where it's made. I know that even within some companies, some manufacturers, they'll have different production facilities. And so depending on which drug it is, it may be made in different places.
Oh.
Even though there's some medications that say even though they're made in the United States, they're technically manufactured in a lot of the Puerto Rican manufacturing facilities, which is a U.S. territory, but it's not necessarily made in the continental United States. So again, talking to your pharmacist, using them as a resource, to determine which medication it is, who the manufacturer is, and then being in touch with them, and as best you can find out perhaps where the product that you individually have access to is being manufactured.
You may or may not have read any research on this, but Nancy emailed and wondered about Alzheimer's and some medications. She said she's heard that Benadryl and Xanax and Tylenol might have some relationship or cause causing of Alzheimer's disease. Have you read anything that might suggest a possible connection?
I'll take that, I guess, because they all sort of fall into my territory with sleeping medications, although Xanax is certainly an anxiety medication, too. I know I had seen a study a while ago about the benzodiazepines increasing the risk of certain memory difficulties, including development of Alzheimer's. And so there's been some observational studies, as we call them. They're not randomized, controlled clinical trials where they can show a causation, but there's been some studies published that show what we call an association between them. And I don't think that it's at a point where you could say, I should stop taking these because we have really firm evidence that these medications are going to cause Alzheimer's. I would definitively say we do not have that evidence in hand yet, but we have some evidence saying, hey, there's an interesting thing that we've noticed with regards to a lot of people who take these medications. This is something that should be looked at more in depth, perhaps studied in a big trial if they can do that from a logistical standpoint, and then go from there. It's definitely a good question and something to I like the fact, Nancy, that you're on top of things and you're paying attention to your medications. You're a very engaged patient that pharmacists love to have and talk to. But also, you know, ask those questions to pharmacists, stay engaged, ask if there's anything current, anything new, and then act appropriately based on input from your physician and from your other healthcare team, including the pharmacist.
I want to get one other question in, a Facebook question from Jeanette, who says, five of my doctors have either retired or moved in the past couple of years. How do I handle a prescription renewal without having to see my new doctor each time? There should be an easy transfer process without having to see, you know, a new doctor every time. Casey.
So I work in a primary care clinic. When a doctor does leave the practice, the patients are dispersed to other primary care doctors there that will take refill requests. Now, no saying that the doctor won't want you to come in at some point, but generally they can give you at least a couple of refills until you're able to make an appointment to come in so you don't have to come in right away. You could also contact your pharmacist to contact the clinic for you to try to get those medications refilled. But there is usually a process where they cover patients until they find another primary care doctor that they get in to see.
Well, boy, we covered a lot today, but there's all of our lines are filled and there's plenty more we could talk about. So I hope you too will think about coming back and seeing us again. We'd be love to have you back.
Thank you, Larry. We'd love to come back. This is really great.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Casey Gallimore is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Pharmacy. She practices at the William T. Evans Access Community Health Center. Works a lot with behavioral issues, psychiatric and medical care to patients. John Dopp, associate professor at the UW School of Pharmacy, and works a lot with sleep disorders and a team. Both of them work in teams, and obviously that's something they've stressed today. And we'll have them back, certainly. Hopefully they'll come back, and we'll do this all over again. We have learned a lot. I did, anyway. I hope you did, too, about what to ask pharmacists, what to tell them, some of the medications. Coming up next, we're going to cover another important topic that deals with health and safety, and that has to do with child abuse. April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month. And Cheryl Cato of the Rainbow Project, somebody I interviewed many times, but not for a long time. So it's great to have her back to talk about what you and I can do to protect vulnerable children. So stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.